KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Chief Justice Roberts is brushing back the president's call to impeach a judge who ruled against him. We hear from two legal voices on how the courts are responding to the administration's policies. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Russia says we're entering a new world order after the call between Presidents Trump and Putin over the war in Ukraine. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Amy Martinez. Could a Russia-U.S. thaw drive a wedge between Moscow and Tehran? Also, why Pepsi's spending almost $2 billion for the prebiotic brand Poppy. It's Thursday, March 20th, 40 years ago today. Libby Riddles braved blizzards to become the first woman to win the Iditarod sled race. The next three races were also won by a woman, Susan Butcher. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Sirens sounded around Tel Aviv today. They were followed by a series of explosions. The Israeli military said projectiles were fired from southern Gaza and were either intercepted or fell in, quote, open areas. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports from Tel Aviv. Hamas later claimed responsibility.
It was the first military response by Hamas since Israel broke the ceasefire in Gaza earlier this week, with a series of airstrikes that killed more than 400 Palestinians, including many children, and wounded hundreds more. Israel then launched a ground invasion into Gaza and has continued with airstrikes, especially in the north, killing dozens more. On the militant group's Telegram channel, Hamas said it fired rockets at Tel Aviv in response for Israel's strikes and the killing of civilians. Earlier this morning, sirens also sounded throughout much of central Israel as the Iran-backed Houthis fired a missile from Yemen. The group said the target was Ben Gurion Airport. Israel says it was intercepted before crossing into Israeli territory. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has told the media President Trump was attentive during their phone call yesterday. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports.
Zelensky told reporters he had a wide-ranging talk with President Trump about all the issues facing Ukraine, the destruction of power plants and civilian infrastructure, the kidnapped children, the bombed churches, and lost historical identity. He also said Russian President Vladimir Putin believes he's in a strong position on the battlefield, so doesn't really want to end the war now.
Зробити pressing.
We see him amassing troops to put pressure on us, said Zelensky, scaring people with drones and missiles, all to give the Russians better conditions for ending the war. Zelensky said Ukraine needs more air defense while it waits for the ceasefire. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Kyiv.
NPR has learned President Trump is poised to sign an executive action today. It directs the U.S. Secretary of Education to move toward closing the Department of Education and giving oversight to the states. This move has been expected for weeks. About half of the Education Department's staff has already been told they're being laid off. The American Federation of Teachers is suing the U.S. Education Department. The union says the Trump administration has improperly shut down access to a program. This program lets students apply for affordable repayment plans for student loans. A federal jury in Minnesota has convicted two people in a multi-million dollar fraud scheme. Minnesota Public Radio's Matt Sepik reports this is in connection with a pandemic-era federal nutrition program.
Jurors found Amy Bach, the founder of the nonprofit Feeding Our Future, and former restaurant owner Salim Saeed guilty in the $250 million scheme. Prosecutors say the two exploited pandemic-era rule changes in federal child nutrition programs and submitted thousands of phony meal reimbursement claims. The two are among 70 people who've been charged since 2022.
Matt Sepik reporting. You're listening to NPR. The head of the passenger railroad Amtrak is resigning. Stephen Gardner has led Amtrak for 3 years. He's leaving after billionaire Elon Musk, who's also the head of Doge, called to privatize Amtrak. California highway officials say a major entrance to Yosemite National Park is closed. Heavy rain triggered a rock slide. The highway is thickly covered with debris. California officials don't know when they'll be able to clear the road. Yosemite is more than 100 miles east of San Francisco. A new study out today makes the case that most art museums should be free to the public. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports The study analyzes the operating costs and visitor numbers of more than 150 U.S. museums.
High entry fees are a major reason why people don't go to art museums. The study's findings show that making museums free actually lowers the cost per visitor, especially for small and mid-sized museums. Stephen Riley is the founding director of ReMuseum, the think tank behind the report.
Museums are not businesses. They're philanthropic institutions providing a public good for people.
Riley says choosing to get rid of entry fees doesn't make sense for every museum, and the study does not address how art institutions might recoup the lost revenue if they choose to go free. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
An annual report finds that, once again, the happiest country in the world is Finland. The University of Oxford has released its World Happiness Report. It examined kindness and how people care for one another. The U.S. fell one rung to 24th place on the World Happiness Report. The UN says today is the International Day of Happiness. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kresge Foundation. Established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Coming up, differing views on Chief Justice Roberts' rare statement that impeachment is not the way to deal with disputes over judges' rulings. But first,
the Federal Reserve is warning that President Trump's new tariffs could hurt the U.S. economy.
The central bank on Wednesday cut its economic growth forecast and raised its expectations for inflation. Fed Chair Jerome Powell said that tariffs are playing a role in inflation.
Clearly, some of it, a good part of it, is coming from tariffs.
President Trump said later on social media that the Fed, an independent agency, should lower rates as tariffs set in.
NPR financial correspondent Maria Aspin joins us now to explain. So, Maria, President Trump often called on Jerome Powell to lower rates in his first term. So why then and why now?
Well, the Fed's interest rates set the bar for what consumers pay for all kinds of loans, cars, credit cards, business loans, and lower rates mean, in general, lower loan prices for consumers. But yesterday, the Fed did exactly what had been expected. It held interest rates steady. And it also signaled that it's still on track to cut interest rates twice later this year. That said, a lot has changed in the last several weeks. President Trump has been implementing a very aggressive and very chaotic trade policy with these on-again, off-again tariffs against some of the country's largest trading partners. We've seen all this uncertainty hit consumers and businesses and stock market investors. And now the Fed is also saying that, yeah, it's dealing with more uncertainty around the economic outlook. The Fed isn't taking any major action yet, but it did say yesterday it's now expecting the economy to grow more slowly this year than it previously projected and inflation to grow faster.
But why isn't the Fed taking more action?
It says the underlying economy is still strong. Unemployment remains low and prices are still relatively stable compared to a couple of years ago. This is Chair Powell yesterday.
We will be watching very carefully for signs of weakness in the real data. Of course we will. But given where we are, we think our policy is in a good place to react to what comes, and we think that the right thing to do is to wait here for greater clarity about what the economy is doing.
Now, the Fed's job is to take the long-term view and to be steady. That becomes even more important in an uncertain environment. And Powell is also trying to maintain the Fed's independence from the White House at a time when President Trump wants to exert more control over independent agencies. So Powell is threading this needle of doing what's best for the overall economy without perhaps provoking the White House to take action against him or the Fed.
Now, despite the Fed's warnings about the economy, investors seem pretty confident. The Dow closed up more than, actually almost 400 points. So what has reassured investors so much?
Powell was pretty mild in his comments overall, and that's kind of his job. As you know, some of the market sell-off we saw last week started when President Trump said he couldn't rule out a recession amid a lot of warnings about the economic damage his tariffs could do. And the argument Trump is making is that tariffs will be good for the U.S. long-term, and that will be worth any shorter-term pain. But most people don't really want to experience any pain, even if it does turn out to be shorter term. So when Powell emphasized yesterday that the U.S. economy is strong and prices aren't soaring up too much yet, at least for the day, that was a pretty reassuring message.
All right, that's NPR's Maria Aspen. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
There is some tension between the courts and the Trump administration. The Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts, issued a statement this week warning that impeaching a judge is not the right way to deal with disagreements over rulings. Now, that's after President Trump called for the impeachment of the judge handling the case of migrants deported to El Salvador. Here's a sampling of the reaction from the administration, starting with White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller.
It is the most outrageous thing I've seen from a district court judge in my lifetime, but frankly, going back multiple lifetimes.
We're not stopping. I don't care what the judges think. I don't care what the left thinks. We're coming.
These are judges that shouldn't be allowed. I think at a certain point, you have to start looking at what do you do when you have a rogue judge.
We also heard there from Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, and the president himself, both speaking on Fox News. So let's discuss this with two people with different perspectives. Margo Cleveland is with the New Civil Liberties Alliance, an organization that says its mission is to protect against what it calls the administrative state's overreach. She also spent 25 years as a clerk to a judge on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. Hello, Margo.
Hello.
Also with us is Michael Gearhart, a constitutional law professor at UNC Chapel Hill. So, Michael, let's start with you. One point that Republicans make is that a single judge should not have the power to issue restraining orders or injunctions that stop a president's actions nationwide. So are judges here improperly making it difficult for President Trump to carry out his policies?
Well, let's clarify two things at the outset. I mean, the first is that that is a fair question. It's an important question. But it's a phenomenon that it happened under President Biden, and nobody heard anything from any Republicans in Congress or, for that matter, from conservatives elsewhere. So it's a little late now for the administration to be worrying about that, but it is a fair question. I think it's hypocritical for some administration officials to claim that that's a problem now when they had no problem when it affected President Biden. But again, to be sure, it's a fair question that the Supreme Court will have to deal with at some point.
So, Margo, Michael mentions the Biden administration. Republican attorneys generals used the courts to win several national injunctions against the Biden administration. Were those injunctions improper?
So, again, on the question of nationwide injunctions, I've had a problem with them under both administrations. And I think you have to look at a couple things. The difference is in 2 months, we have had more TROs and injunctions entered under the Trump administration than under 4 years under the Biden administration. But there is a problem with nationwide injunctions, and the Supreme Court is likely to put a halt to that.
Now, when it comes to Chief Justice, we mentioned the rare statement from him that impeachment is not a cure for disagreements on court rulings. Margo, you say that that was imprudent. What is wrong with stressing normal appellate procedure?
Actually, I don't think I've ever said that his statement was imprudent. I think that the Chief Justice has taken the position and tries to defend his branch of government, which makes sense for him to do. And when we speak of impeachment, I think that we have to keep in mind that oftentimes disagreements with the president call for the president's impeachment. I do think that in this case that we haven't gotten to the level where any of these justices have done anything with their rulings that require an impeachment, although they have entered rulings that have been clearly unconstitutional, and in many cases that have vastly exceeded their jurisdiction that Congress actually limited.
Michael, where do you stand on that when it comes to what Chief Justice said?
Well, I agree that the Chief Justice of the United States, and that's his official title, has as a primary obligation and duty to try to protect the integrity of the federal judiciary more generally. I think that statement is quite consistent with that duty. At the same time, I think the Chief Justice believed it was time to try and help educate the American people about a very basic point of constitutional law. It never hurts to clarify that point or to repeat it. The point being, as the Chief Justice said, then throughout our history, no judge has ever been impeached, convicted, and removed on the basis of their decisions. There is a constitutional process for dealing with any errors by lower court judges, and that is to appeal them. The decisions have been appealed, and that's the proper process. The only other thing I would say is that to the extent that there are more TROs or injunctions now, that is because the president has been much more active in pushing the boundaries of his powers, if not exceeding the boundaries of his powers, and that's why we've got so many lawsuits.
Margaret, do you have more of a problem with injunctions as opposed to temporary restraining orders?
Actually, it would be the opposite. Okay. The bigger concern is the temporary restraining orders, because those can be done ex parte, and there is no appeal process if they are generally a TRO, a temporary restraining order. But in many of these cases, the judges have not done restraining orders. They've actually done injunctions where they've ordered the court to do something. But again, you have to look at each of the cases and say, was the order appropriate? And in many of the cases, they haven't been. We've already had cases where the appellate courts have stayed what the lower court did. So using this process, and I think we're going to see several more of the appellate cases, the appellate courts that are going to be reversing these injunctions and restraining orders that have gone beyond the powers of these lower court judges.
How do you each of you feel about the rhetoric around judges right now and how that maybe affects their ability to do their jobs? Michael, let's start with you on that.
Well, I'm concerned about the rhetoric, and that's, I think, one reason why the Chief Justice issued his statement. I think he's concerned about the rhetoric because the rhetoric can lapse into violence against judges, and that's not appropriate. We also ought to keep in mind that the rhetoric that's directed against these judges is really driven by political sort of agendas. So it's a political critique of judges trying to do their jobs. And I think we shouldn't confuse the two things. Politics is one thing. Judges, generally speaking, should not be doing any kind of politics. They're doing law. They're trying to interpret the law and apply it as best they can to the circumstances that they're facing.
Margaret, you have the last word on that. You got about 30 seconds.
Sure. So unfortunately, the rhetoric was probably no higher than when the Dobbs decision was before the Supreme Court. And we saw that coming out, and it was a very large problem. But I think we also have to keep in mind that a lot of these judges are actually doing politics, and that is what is in some ways pushing the disagreement. But the disagreement, that type of speech, is completely appropriate.
Margo Cleveland of the New Civil Liberties Alliance and Michael Gerhart, UNC Chapel Hill Law School professor. Michael, Margo, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, the New Yorker staff writer Andrew Marantz joins us to discuss how podcasts, streams, and YouTube channels have become the platforms where men who feel disillusioned and alienated go to feel seen and heard, with many of them gravitating toward the MAGA movement. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. The Kremlin says a call this week between President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin is ushering in a new world order. During that call, Putin did not accept a U.S. offer for a full 30-day ceasefire in Ukraine, but the White House described a partial agreement to stop attacks on energy infrastructure as progress in a movement to peace. Among the countries watching Washington's new overtures toward Moscow is Iran. Russia and Iran are partners on many geopolitical issues, including the war in Ukraine, where Russia has launched scores of Iranian drones on Ukrainian cities. So how might a warming of U.S.-Russian relations affect Tehran? To discuss this, we're joined by Karim Sajidpour. He is a senior fellow in the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Good morning, and thank you for being on the program.
Great to be with you, Leila.
So you've written extensively about what you call the Russia-Iran partnership of defiance. Could the U.S. now getting closer with Russia serve to pull that bond apart?
I'm skeptical of that, Leila, because I think at the end of the day, over the last decade, Iran and Russia have been kind of like the Bonnie and Clyde of global geopolitics. They've been bound together by this common opposition to the United States and the U.S.-led world order. And that fundamentally hasn't changed. Both Vladimir Putin and Iran's leadership maintain that opposition to the U.S.-led world order. What has changed is the United States' position. But
right.
You know, ultimately, I think Russia is going to continue to pursue its own interests, extracting concessions from the United States, but to continue to maintain a strategic relationship with Iran.
What does Iran gain or lose as the Trump administration really shows more openness to Moscow?
What Iranian leaders fear is that Russia could throw them under the bus in the context of a Russia-United States rapprochement. And, you know, Iran is a country which is deeply isolated, one of the most sanctioned countries in the world. And in a way, Russia benefits from an isolated Iran, because an isolated Iran is far more dependent on Russian technology, Russian strategic support. So I think Moscow's endgame is in some ways the status quo. They benefit from an unstable Middle East in which the free flow of oil is disrupted and the risk premium of energy prices are higher. They benefit from Iran, which is isolated, dependent on them. But at times they will pretend to be helpful to the United States in checking Iran's nuclear ambitions, which is also, I would argue, a Russian priority. They at the same time don't want Iran to have a nuclear weapon.
Now, do you think, though, that the U.S. could depend on Russia to really be a reliable partner in countering Iran's power in the region?
I don't think so. I think fundamentally the U.S. national interest vis-a-vis Iran is very different than the Russian national interest. Ultimately, the United States wants to see a Middle East which is stable. Its partners and allies like the United, like Israel and Gulf countries feel protected. There's a free flow of energy from the region. Those aren't strong Russian priorities. So, again, I think at times Putin will continue to play both sides. He'll pretend to be helpful to the United States. He'll pretend to be helpful to Iran. But ultimately, you know, he has his own interests, which are very different than that of the United States.
And the United States, the Trump administration's approach to Iran itself, you know, early on in the administration, we heard them talking about opening talks again with Iran. This week, though, we're hearing President Trump say that Iran will pay dire consequences over Houthi attacks, which Iran backs. I mean, what is the Trump administration's approach to Iran?
I think President Trump has a very narrow approach toward Iran, which is almost exclusively focused on reversing Iran's nuclear program. And he has apparently a great sense of urgency to do that. He reportedly has sent in a letter to Iran that they have essentially 2 months to freeze their nuclear program. And his strategy is to subject Iran to enormous economic pressure, sanctions, coercion, and a military threat in order for Iran to compromise. And, you know, this is the U.S.-Iran Cold War has now persisted for 46 years, and it's very unlikely that it's going to be resolved in a couple months.
Karim Sajidpour at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lila.
A new generation of soda. That's the pitch Pepsi bought this week for nearly $2 billion. NPR's Alina Selyuk reports on what Pepsi hopes to gain with the upstart brand Poppy.
About a decade ago was the heyday of the fermented tea many love to hate, kombucha.
But it had a lot of practical issues.
Martin Caballero is the managing editor at the beverage industry trade publication, BevNet.com. He says kombucha is finicky, needs refrigeration, and, well...
It tastes was polarizing.
It's not for everyone. The stage was set for a new type of fizzy health drink. In Texas, Allison and Stephen Ellsworth experimented with apple cider vinegar. And in 2018, they brought their pitch to ABC's Shark Tank.
So what do you say, sharks? Are you ready to try the best tasting apple cider vinegar drink you've ever had?
They called it Mother Beverage. But after that investment from one of the sharks, the brand transformed into Poppy. Vibrant cans showed up in Whole Foods and Walmart, claiming to be prebiotic, containing fiber meant to feed the good bacteria in our guts.
And that sort of coincided with a big interest around gut health as a wellness trend.
This week, Poppy actually settled a class action lawsuit that argued it had overstated the gut health benefits of its drinks. And Caballero points out, Poppy had been shifting its marketing. Now it's less health drink and more healthier soda. Here's a Super Bowl commercial.
It tastes like soda, looks like soda, smells like soda, and fizzes like soda. Because it is soda.
Stealing shoppers from Diet Pop is a big deal. Coca-Cola just launched its own prebiotic soda called Simply Pop, and Pepsi wanted in to add to its Gatorade, SodaStream, and Bubbly. And Poppy fans online say they just hope their favorite better-for-you soda does not get worse for you in the process. Alina Selyuk, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
A Veterans Affairs home loan program has so far saved thousands of vets from foreclosure. They needed saving because of the VA's own mistake. But now an effort in Congress could kill the program.
Getting rid of something that would keep me and my family in a home is just intentionally cruel.
I'm Elsa Chang. That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump is expected to sign an executive order today to begin the process of dismantling the Department of Education. The order directs Education Secretary Linda McMahon to take the necessary steps to close the department. Trump has said he wants to shift oversight of education to the states. Kentucky's Lieutenant Governor is Democrat Jacqueline Coleman.
If the U.S. Department of Education is dismantled,
The states who will suffer the most are places like Kentucky. And the people who stand to lose the most are our most vulnerable.
The president is expected to sign that order at the White House this afternoon. The president has fired the two Democratic members of the Federal Trade Commission, Rebecca Kelly Slaughter and Alvaro Bedoya. Critics say the move threatens the FTC's independence as it enforces consumer protections and antitrust laws. Bedoya tells NPR's Morning Edition,
in a world where the president can fire anyone at any time, if they can, they have a choice. They can either obey, or if they say no, what will happen to them is what has just happened to me.
Legal challenges are expected. Sales of existing homes in the U.S. rose 4.2% last month. The National Association of Realtors cites in part more properties on the market. This is NPR News from Washington. The Federal Reserve is leaving interest rates unchanged. The central bank wrapped up its latest policy meeting yesterday, with Fed Chair Jerome Powell saying the Fed is in no hurry to move on rates. It wants to assess the effects of President Trump's policies, including tariffs, on the U.S. economy. The Fed is signaling it expects to cut rates by a quarter point twice later this year. One of the largest unions representing employees of the U.S. Postal Service is holding rallies across the country today. As NPR's Hansi Lo Wang reports, workers are protesting efforts by the Trump administration to reshape the Postal Service.
Members of the American Postal Workers Union are demonstrating in more than 100 locations against President Trump's comments last month. They confirmed his administration is considering having the Commerce Department take control of what Congress set up to be an independent postal service. Legal experts say that will likely spark a lawsuit. Trump has also said privatizing the country's mail service is, quote, not the worst idea he's ever heard. APWU President Mark Dimenstein says he's worried that could lead to higher shipping rates and the closing of local post offices.
We say over and over, the U.S. mail is not for sale. Hands off our public postal service.
The head of USPS recently signed an agreement to work with Elon Musk's Doge team to find efficiencies. Hansi Lo Wang, NPR News, Washington.
The Postal Service is a financial supporter of NPR. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. A federal judge in Washington, D.C. has denied a request to block the Department of Government Efficiency's takeover of the U.S. Institute of Peace.
That's despite the fact that the judge has serious concerns about the tactics DOGE used to force its way into USIP.
NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas was at the federal courthouse yesterday in Washington. So, Ryan, all this stems from a lawsuit that was filed by several members of the USIP board. What is it that they were asking the court to do here?
Right. Five members of the USIP board filed this lawsuit overnight Tuesday. The court held a hearing on it Wednesday afternoon, so that gives you a sense of the urgency here. What the lawsuit argues is that the USIP board members were unlawfully removed from their positions by President Trump. They say that USIP is an independent, nonprofit think tank created and funded by Congress, so it's not a part of the executive branch, they say. The board members who are suing, they want to be reinstated. They want to stop the Trump administration's efforts to dismantle the Institute and its operations. Now, at this hearing, what they were asking the judge to do was to temporarily block DOJ's takeover of USIP, to get DOJ out of the Institute and its systems, and to get the board members back in.
Yeah, and the judge denied that request. So what was her reasoning?
Well, U.S. District Judge Beryl Howell said that there was confusion in this complaint itself, in the lawsuit. She also pointed out that a temporary restraining order, which is the specific ask that was being made yesterday, is really an extraordinary step. There are certain thresholds, legal thresholds, that have to be met for a court to agree to take that step. And what Howell said was that a couple of those thresholds just weren't met, including the likelihood of this lawsuit to succeed on the merits. So she declined to block DOJ's takeover. For now, DOJ will be allowed to remain in control of the U.S. Institute of Peace for the time being as the court continues to consider this lawsuit. But still, Howell made very clear at this hearing that she had very serious concerns about DOJ and how it had gone about gaining access to USIP.
Yeah, the DOJ staff went into that building with the help of D.C. police. I mean, is that what the judge was concerned about? Is that what she was talking about?
Yes, but it wasn't just that. Two FBI agents also made a house call to the head of USIP security over the weekend to question him. The lawsuit also alleges that FBI agents threatened a criminal investigation, that the D.C. U.S. Attorney's Office also threatened a criminal investigation. I'll say prosecutors didn't dispute that at yesterday's hearing. And then you also have, as you said, armed D.C. police officers showing up at USIP and escorting senior staff from the building. Judge Howell said that she was, quote unquote here, very offended by how DOJ has operated at USIP, by how it treated American citizens, as the judge said, just trying to do their job. She said that those actions were probably terrorizing for folks at USIP, and she asked, why act like that? Why was it just because DOJ was in a rush?
Well, there's a lot of tension between the courts and the Trump administration, and this case is a part of that. Now, this ruling went the administration's way, but a lot of court rulings in the lawsuits challenging administration policies have not.
That's right. There are a lot of cases out there right now challenging administration policies. The president and his allies have been lashing out at judges who have ruled against the administration. They've called for judges to be impeached. Chief Justice John Roberts issued a rare statement this week pushing back on that. Now, judges always say that they rule on the facts and the law that are before them in a given case. And look, I was in court last week when Judge Howell blocked a Trump order targeting a law firm. And then yesterday, same judge, Judge Howell, looked at the facts and the law in the USIP case and declined to block DOJ's actions at USIP.
All right, that's NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas. Ryan, thanks.
Thank you.
A jury in North Dakota says Greenpeace should pay a pipeline company more than $660 million. The verdict for defamation, trespassing, and other claims was for Greenpeace's role in protests against the Dakota Access oil pipeline almost a decade ago. The case was brought by Energy Transfer, the company that built the pipeline. Mary Stoyer is a reporter at the North Dakota Monitor. She's been following the trial, and she joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Mary, $660 million, that's a lot of money. What exactly was Greenpeace found liable for?
So, the jury found Greenpeace USA responsible for claims like trespassing, nuisance, and essentially depriving Energy Transfer of its property during the protests, mm-hmm. as well as aiding and abetting others to do the same. It's a bit tricky because the lawsuit was also against two other Greenpeace organizations, Greenpeace International and Greenpeace Fund, and those two weren't found responsible for the on-the-ground damages to the pipeline, but the jury did find that all three had defamed Energy Transfer. So Energy Transfer says that Greenpeace made public statements about the pipeline that harmed its reputation, especially with banks and other investors that mm-hmm. financed its construction loans. And those statements included that the pipeline encroaches on tribal land and that Energy Transfer deliberately destroyed sacred cultural burial sites and some other claims.
What has Greenpeace said, if anything, since the ruling?
So Greenpeace's stance in the suit is that it did support the protests, including through sending supplies and funding nonviolent training for protesters, but that its involvement was very marginal and that it never supported or engaged in the kind of property damage that Energy Transfer says it did. And right after the jury issued its verdict, some attorneys with Greenpeace also reiterated that the movement was led by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and that Greenpeace was never a major organizing force on the ground. As for the defamation claims, Greenpeace has maintained that all of the statements that were attributed to it during the lawsuit were circulated by other organizations before it ever said a word, but that also all of the statements were credible.
Now, Energy Transfer here is a big winner. What have they said about the verdict?
Their attorneys after the verdict, of course, were very happy. They said that justice had won. And I think they've also kind of maintained throughout the case and also said afterwards that, you know, the company isn't against protesting, but that they just don't want it to be illegal. And so this was kind of in their view, a win for the rule of law.
So they're saying they're not against protesting, but they want it to be done legally. Does Greenpeace have the money here to pay this, and how will it impact them just in the few seconds we have left?
Greenpeace has said before that they kind of feared this verdict would sink them. Yesterday afternoon, however, their attorneys gave more of an indirect answer. They said simply that they would keep fighting.
Mary Stoyer is a reporter at the North Dakota Monitor. Thank you for joining us, Mary.
Thank you.
This is NPR News. Gain trust in science? Former NIH Director Francis Collins says yes. We'll hear about a recent summit he helmed at MIT next time, Here and Now.
From your car radio to your smart speaker, NPR meets you where you are in a lot of different ways. Now we're in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, May Martinez. A few years ago, we told you about Murphy, the bald eagle in Missouri Zoo that tried to hatch a rock. People flocked to see him, but what Murphy was trying to do with the rock is not actually that odd. Some birds will try to hatch round objects if they get too hormonal. Now, some sad news as Murphy died this week from a head injury. He was 33. He survived by the two actual eagles that he helped raise as a foster dad and, of course, the rock he tried to hatch. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. Who doesn't love a good underdog story? Year after year, the NCAA basketball tournament usually delivers with a Cinderella team emerging from the pack. That's a low-seeded team that, against all odds, continues to win and knock off better teams. But can these teams be made, or is it all just luck? Martenzie Johnson of ESPN's Antscape is on the line with us to talk about this. So, Martenzie, what are the qualities of a great Cinderella story?
Good morning, A. I have a few theories on how, you know, a Cinderella can get through, right? I think, first of all, you have to have a star player who just shines when, you know, the lights are the brightest. So you think of Steph Curry in 2008, kind of the legend of him is born at Davidson when they get to the Final Four, or even last year, Oakland with Jack Golkey, who made 16 three-pointers over the two games that Oakland got through. Speaking of three-pointers, you have to make three-pointers, right? So Oakland made a lot of those. They made 15 team versus Kentucky, which is how they upset the number one seed last year. And then, you know, you can go back to 2018, Loyola never shot below 38% from three. So you got to make those threes. And then you got to play defense, right? Because if you can't limit the other team, then you have absolutely no chance because you're kind of outmanned there. And St. Peter's did that, I think, in 2022, where they, when they played Kentucky and Purdue, they never allowed either of them to shoot over 30% from threes. And lastly, I think the real key to being a Cinderella is you got to play Purdue or Kentucky, right? Kentucky lost his 14 seed Oakland in 2024. They lost to a 15 seed St. Peter's in 2022. And then Purdue lost to a 16 seed in 2023. They lost to a 15 seed in 2022. And then they lost to a 13 seed North Texas in 2021. Now, that all being said, Purdue did go to the national championship last year. But if you play those two teams, you got a really good chance.
Well, so high point. 13 seed playing 4 seed Purdue. I mean, and you got to have a cool name to be a Cinderella story too. High Point. I mean, what a team name. That looks like a winner right there.
Yeah, so they have one of the qualifications. I didn't mention this, but you got to be able to rebound too. So if you can get second chance points for yourself, obviously that leads to more points, right? But then you can limit the second chance points to the other team as well. And High Point is the 24th ranked team in the nation when it comes to rebounding. That might not sound like a lot, right? But there are over 100 teams that we're talking about here. So that's pretty good for a really low seed. And they can make three-pointers. Now, granted, Purdue can defend that pretty well, but this is March. They call it March Madness. You never really know. So High Point has a really good chance.
My cousin told me that we should root for Drake University because the rapper Drake had such a tough time against Kendrick Lamar in his battle. So we should root for that Drake instead.
Yeah, see, hey, we haven't talked hip-hop really in a few times that I come on. I'm not the biggest Drake fan, so I got to go against your cousin here. They might have a chance, but when you're named Drake in 2025, it's not looking too good for you.
All right, so any team in particular you have your eye on to be the Cinderella story?
Yeah, actually watching last night, Mount St. Mary, who played American University. I know this is going to sound crazy because Duke is one of the few teams we've heard about this year, and they're a number one seed. But Cooper Flagg did hurt his ankle during the conference tournament. The Duke still won without him in the championship, but he's hobbled. And St. Mary's, out of all these Cinderella teams, I got to tell you, A, they do the basics right. They can make layups. They don't look awkward shooting three-pointers. They can make three-pointers. And one thing that, you know, a lot of teams that we're talking about here have in common is that they have a lot of juniors and seniors, and Mount St. Mary has that.
They play together. That means they're a stronger team, right? Martenzie Johnson of ESPN's Antscape, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Did you almost forget your name there?
Almost.
We're leading with the breakfast cereal indicator, showing worried consumers getting careful about even groceries.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Amazon Business, dedicated to helping businesses save time on office tasks and empower leaders with business buying solutions that support teams to focus on growing the business. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com.
I'm David Brancaccio. General Mills has now told investors it expects sales to fall as much as 2% this year. Campbell's and Kraft Heinz also expect business to slow. This is everyday stuff, but a strong signal about the state of the economy. Marketplace's Henry Epp reports.
Inflation over the past couple years has made trips to the grocery store a lot harder for many Americans, and a lot of folks expect prices will keep going up. That's influencing the choices they make when they shop for food, says Ed Johnson, who focuses on consumer industries at Deloitte.
The places where we're seeing that choice manifest is only buying essentials, right? So maybe that's, think about categories in the grocery store that are maybe seen as simple indulgences or as nice to haves.
Snacks, soda, some shoppers are skipping those, he says, or they're trading down from name brands to the generic versions. But executive editor of Supermarket News, Chloe Riley, says those store brands aren't immune either because low-income consumers are getting pinched by rising prices for basics like coffee and eggs.
Consumers are cutting out many of even the cheaper items as well.
And all these consumer choices are trickling up to corporate offices, says Craig Rowley, who consults with retail companies at Korn Ferry. He says his clients are starting to ask,
what do our expenses look like? If our sales are going to be a little bit slight, what can we do to reduce our expenses?
They could cancel planned investments, leave open jobs unfilled, or even lay off workers. Rowley says his clients aren't making any of those moves yet, but they're exploring their options. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
The people with an optimal readout on the economy left interest rates unchanged yesterday. The Federal Reserve still expects to cut the cost of borrowing perhaps twice as the year goes on amid signs of weakness ahead. But the Fed waited this time partly in case tariffs spike inflation. We do have new data just now from the National Association of Realtors showing existing home sales went up 4.2% in February. This despite higher mortgage rates. Year over year, sales were down 1.2% without much inventory for sale. That said, after the Fed meeting yesterday, the 10-year interest rate is down at 4.21% this morning, and the average 30-year fixed rate mortgage has fallen to its lowest in 3.5 months using Mortgage News Daily's calculation. Now, the stock market has just turned from negative to positive, with the Dow up 254 points, 0.6%. The S&P is now up 0.5%. The NASDAQ up 0.7%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Bitwarden Password Manager. Spring is a great time to clean up digital clutter. Bitwarden is password management designed to securely store and autofill all logins across all accounts and devices. Learn more at bitwarden.com. And by Odoo, offering software that provides building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what small businesses need.
This week, it's a business reporter, yours truly, goes to the rodeo. What can we learn from people gathering at in-person marketplaces to buy and sell as opposed to all the e-commerce these days? Rodeo Houston is also the Houston Livestock Show, where it was easy to find teenage business whizzes.
And first place in this class goes to Madeline Glaze from El Campo FFA. Second place.
While pro bull riders and calf ropers vie for cash in the NFL grade stadium next door, there's another competition happening in a separate building amid more workaday grandstands and piles of hay dyed green. Young people from across the state show off in front of judges the best of their chickens, pigs, lambs, goats, and cows.
Tremendous class, guys. Let's give them another big round of applause.
You definitely look for their structure. Are they able to walk? Will they make it out and thrive in the real world?
Laura Cooper is a high school senior from Paris, Texas. She drove about 5 hours to show at the rodeo this Brahman, a breed that's beautiful but not always nice.
You also check their temperament. It would be awful if I had a crazy cow and would make it a really long day we're showing, so thankfully she's super gentle.
Cooper was showing Dally, who won several trophies at this year's rodeo. Now what makes Dally worthy of show?
Her color, that red tinge, is just something that's super flashy in the show world. She puts her ears forward, makes her look like a real lady.
Raising and showing livestock is an investment business.
I had to get an ag loan through the FSA, so the Farm Service Agency, to buy my own calf to start out with in the very beginning. From then I learned, wow, this is an awesome opportunity. I get to build credit before age of 18. I was able to sell their offspring, so when they had calves after their show career, I was able to sell those, make a little bit of profit. From then on, it just seems like it was just a repetitive cycle.
Cooper now owns nearly 40 cattle in total herself. She's finishing up both her high school and two-year associate's degree in agribusiness at the same time with this goal in mind.
To one day become a loan officer.
To give farmers and ranchers access to the credit they need.
I do have somewhat of an idea about the worth of some things and assets, a depreciating value. It is something you still continually learn every day, especially with the new current market trends.
Are you checking interest rates every few days?
I try to, for sure.
I find this livestock show is running thick with business aces.
My ranch is called Top Notch Cattle, and we raise registered Brahmin cattle.
Baxter Whitworth from Henderson, Texas. His assets are winning trophies here, too, even as Baxter, age 14, is also building his media business.
It's time for another episode of the Cattle Innovation Station podcast. I'm your host, Baxter. Sometimes we'll talk about ag policy, but mostly it's nutrition, genetics, breeding, herd management. Setting up a farm-to-table or a branded beef program is something that I've definitely
Back at the NRG Center in Houston, Baxter's trick of the trade for showing cattle is something that will also serve him well as a podcast host. It's about showmanship and presence.
Being aware of what's going on in the ring, where the judge is at, where other cattle are at, kind of how much space you have, to kind of be engaging and looking where everything is to make sure everything's all right.
Tomorrow here, turning a goat into money for education as we explore the dynamics of a charity auction at the rodeo. Our Tricks of the Trade coverage is streamable from Marketplace Online. Also, there's some video of how to deconstruct a barbecue sandwich where I save 66% on the price. That's one of our rodeo videos, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. You can search Marketplace APM. I'm David Brancaccio with our morning report. From APM American Public Media.